Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for the first Monday of the new year. My name is Magnus Thiewald.
Peter R.H. here.
Happy New Year, Peter.
Okay.
A very muted response to that. Welcome to Speak Up for this. We're starting a brand new year here and a brand new season, and we're happy to have you here with us on the radio. We got some interesting stuff lined up for you today. We have an interview with Dr. Andy Hira about carbon capture. The government is going to be spending about $8 billion to subsidize carbon capture activities, and Dr. Hira doesn't think it's worth the money. We'll talk a whole bunch more about that in just a few minutes. We also have a report about an Indigenous-made horror film produced up in Northeast BC, the first local horror film shot in the Indigenous language there. So that's pretty cool. What are you going to be talking about,
Peter? Oh, I'm going to be talking about a figure. Father Divine was his name, and he was he had a questionable kind of a cult. It was a Christian religious cult. He died in 1965, but one of the things, like we talk about in the downtown east side, he put all this money into it, and where does it go? Right. He did something. One thing in Harlem, the 1930s, this cult were owning restaurants and businesses, and they were actually providing cheap services to the people in Harlem mm-hmm. during the 1930s. And so that was interesting. Now, the whole cult itself, which we'll get into, there was very questionable things, but it was interesting that he was doing some interesting things in Harlem in the 1930s, this organization. So I'll be bringing that up.
They're doing good, but also perhaps a bit of a cult.
It was very decisively a cult. Okay. It's sort of forgotten history a little bit.
Yeah.
The March of Time did a thing on him during the 1930s.
Right, which is that like a film reel series that would run before.
Well, what it was it went from 1935 to 1951, and it originally had three segments. So he has, since it's the 1930s, his segment was like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was every 4 weeks. And then they went to one segment, for the whole 20 minutes. But he was so high profile at one point that they did do a feature on him. So mm-hmm. anyway.
Very exciting, interesting, odd weekend in the news. And I'd like to say that was unusual, but of course it's become the norm in this era of Trump 2.0.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're aware that the United States launched a sort of raid in force into Venezuela and captured the president of Venezuela on Friday night, Saturday morning, in a very quick operation that would, I'm sure that Vladimir Putin wished at his special military operation in Ukraine almost 4 years ago now was as successful as that. But the United States forces captured and seized Venezuelan President Maduro and have whisked them off now to New York City. Very quick operation that was pretty much over before most people even heard about it. And is It feels like a real throwback to, you know, and maybe thinking of it as a throwback isn't correct, but, you know, throwback to the kind of operations that the United States used to do routinely up until at least the 1980s, intervening in various Latin American countries.
The other thing is that there's a lot of things up in the open, like how is it going to be controlled, Venezuela, and so on. Now, there was a 60 Minutes article pulled a few weeks ago, which is online, and actually maybe we'll get later on. There's a way of putting it onto Google. You get it precisely because it's a bit of a trick to get it. But what happened was that these people had come to the United States from Venezuela seeking asylum.
Now, the story you're talking about is a 60-minute story about the CECOP prison in El Salvador.
Right.
And one of the when way back at the beginning of the year, when Trump first took power, a lot of the people seized were, you know, what he talked about was this Tren de Aragua Venezuelan gang that was so fearsome and violent, and this was a critical national security thing to seize all these Venezuelans, and then ship them off to this basically gulag kind of type prison in El Salvador, but
the thing is that these people were not part of that gang, and so. I wonder if that woman who's now in charge of CBS News, I'm wondering now what they told her was, well, we're going to be doing this attack on Venezuela, and if you show this report, it sort of takes away how you know, we're being nice, we're humanitarian, because that report says, oh, these people come to the United States getting, because they had problem being in Venezuela, and this is how the United States treats them, people that were not part of the gang. So I'm wondering if that woman who's now charged with CBS News was told some information about this raid that happened.
Possibly, or maybe she was just told, wink, wink, don't run this report.
Well, no, I know that.
But, yeah, I mean, the report itself, which was pulled off 60 Minutes News, the 60 Minutes report in the U.S., but it had already been sent to Global TV here in Canada, the complete report, the complete episode with that report in it, and it aired on Global TV here in Canada on Sunday night in the 60 Minutes slot. And therefore, you know, a lot of people were able to get copies of it, and it's been circulated online. I had an opportunity to watch the report afterwards when that was all coming up in the news. And it really does make the case that despite all the rhetoric about Venezuelans and this gang, most of the people sent there, the Venezuelans who were sent there, were just regular folks with tattoos.
Yeah. No, but
basically having tattoos seemed to be the thing that made American authorities decide you're in a gang, regardless of whether there are gang tattoos or not.
I guess my point is that part of the thing that they're making out now, Donald Trump and the administration saying, well, this is a humanitarian thing. Venezuela was they had a dictatorship, and we're helping them out. Well, then you put in context with that thing. Well, didn't you just allow people to come to the United States? They had a problem. Why did you treat people who wanted to flee that dictatorship? And why did you do what you did to them? So it sort of makes them that they're really not doing something on a humanitarian aspect.
Yeah. On Saturday, the Trump administration had a press conference at which, they talked about the raid and what went on. But then they also, Donald Trump basically said that, you know, the U.S. would be running Venezuela until such time as there had been a transition. Even though at that point in the news, it was pretty obvious that what had happened was a sort of raid in force where they dashed in with special forces, seized the president, got him out of the country, and then pulled back and didn't leave forces in the country to actually provide control. So he's talking on Saturday afternoon about how they're going to control the country when they no longer had any forces in the country to do that. And, you know, other administration officials, including Marco Rubio, had to walk that back within the next 24 hours because they didn't actually have a way to control the country unless they were going to launch more raids and or a full-scale invasion. Now they're talking about using, you know, various sort of pressure tactics and the pressure tactics and the sanctions they have in place on the oil industry to try and do that. But of course, you know, as in many of these cases, it's those sanctions, among other things. I mean, the government there hasn't exactly been a great one with lots of corruption, but, you know, as in many of these cases, these heavy sanctions tend to tank the economy of these countries, which is why people, you know, Venezuelans were leaving the country and trying to make their way to the U.S., among other things.
See, he's sort of a rash person, Donald Trump. He just gets his ideas. One example is the aluminum tariffs placed on Canada. Mm-hmm. Then he sort of was like, oh, we're kind of stuck now. We're not getting a lot of aluminum. And he sort of phoned Mark Carney and asked if they would send some aluminum to the United States. And Mark Carney said one word, no. And the thing is that, you know, here is what he just had this idea, a rash idea. And this is the same thing. It's just a rash idea. Like, there's been talk about how is this going to handle our leverage in Canada about our petroleum. Well, they're saying it's going to take a while for Venezuela to actually have the same output that it once did. So
yeah,
it's just,
I've heard discussion as much as 10 years to get things up and going, if not longer.
So it's just like, it's almost like Donald Trump just glides through all the things that are actually important. You know, he just does a rash action. And yeah, this is an example, like how he just said, oh, well, we'll take him over, we'll be in charge. Well, he doesn't even think step one, step two, step three. And no, it's quite
serious.
Yeah,
no, exactly. It's like,
quite serious.
We're going to be in charge, but we didn't actually do, not that we want them to, but we didn't actually put the boots on the ground in the country to actually be in charge.
Well, the other thing is that woman who said is actually the president, because they said she won the election. Now he's saying, oh, I don't want her in charge. So it's just a rash action. He thinks, for the last year, he thinks these rash actions, I don't have to know all the details. Well, he's going to perhaps find out. And also Congress. I think Congress may say that we don't like what you did either.
Well, a lot of people say that he overstepped his authority, never had the authority to actually initiate an action like that without Congress's involvement.
Well, isn't that going to come up in Congress?
The Republicans in Congress are so compliant that they may not want to talk about this because it would be politically embarrassing.
Maybe they're not that compliant.
Seems to be more important than their constitutional role.
Maybe they're not going to be that compliant. We'll see.
Anyway, you know, just to finish off, you know, he's already talking about threatening Colombia, which is a neighbor to Venezuela, threatening Colombia and the Colombian president. And, you know, who knows? And Cuba, apparently.
If I could just
I was just going to say there's a clip of Mitch McConnell on Trump's airplane talking about how they needed to I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but basically needed to take out Cuba.
Well, Cuba's a dictatorship, but what about Colombia? I don't think that's a dictatorship. I don't think that has a bad political system right now. So that's... Yep. Why would you be threatening that?
And, you know, I mean, even if they are one or the other are dictatorships, unfortunately, there are lots of those in the world. And the U.S. and even Canada and other countries are quite happy to do business with dictatorships when it's convenient. And then when it's inconvenient, all of a sudden, they're the worst people in the world.
No, I agree.
You know, it's very, you know, there's no consistency, you know, on American or Western policy around dealing with or without dictatorships, and you can't just
But my point is, Columbia isn't.
Yeah.
So it's totally invalid. To
yeah.
Be sort of.
Absolutely.
So that's what my point
absolutely.
Was.
Absolutely. All right. The Canadian government is planning to spend about $8 billion to support carbon capture programs in Canada as one of the sort of legs of our policy to try and reduce carbon emissions here in Canada and meet our international agreements. Dr. Andy Hira of SFU's Department of Political Sciences has written a paper about that and has grave concerns about whether this is a good policy and more particularly a good use of resources in the fight against climate change and carbon in the environment. I talked to Dr. Andy Hira just before the holidays, and here's our conversation.
This is CICK News. WhatsApp is not a traditional...
Oops, sorry about that. We'll get our correct story here. There we go. Sorry. We will be coming back to that story in a bit.
The film made by...
Let's give you a little bird note while we get this set up properly. Oh, no, here we go.
This is Bird Note. If we ran down the list of our most familiar songbirds, like crows, robins, and jays, we wouldn't have to go all that far to reach the wrens. They are little brown birds with cocked tails and big voices. There are nearly 90 species of wrens in the world. Nearly all of them reside in the Western Hemisphere, from Alaska to the Falkland Islands. The majority live in Central and South America, and quite a few are exceptional singers. Many wrens are small and secretive. The white-bellied wren of Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize ranks among the tiniest, at just under 4 inches. The white-bellied wren is tough to get a look at, but its brisk musical song reveals its presence as it skulks through the tropical underbrush. The largest of the wrens, the giant wren, is found only in a small area of Mexico and Guatemala. Giant wrens are as big as red-winged blackbirds, nearly 9 inches long, with rusty brown backs and white undersides. Far from shy, they call raucously as they chase one another through open woodlands. Among all the wrens, which is the most legendary singer? It's a tough decision, but many would choose South America's musician wren. Learn more about this little bird's special song on our website, birdnote.org. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCain.
Joining me here in the studio is Dr. Anil Hira, professor of political science, and also you're the director of the Clean Energy Research Group here at SFU?
That's right.
You've recently produced a report with some colleagues on carbon capture and what role it can play in mitigating greenhouse gases. Can you tell me a bit about that?
It's a really important topic. It's been largely neglected by the Canadian media, but it is something that governments around the world are pouring billions of dollars into. And the idea is to capture carbon dioxide at the source, that is, at oil and gas wells or large industrial factories that are using diesel or electric generators such as gas-fired turbines in Alberta. And the idea is to take that carbon dioxide, put it into a pipe, essentially, and bury it underground so that you reduce the emissions. Now, one can imagine, just thinking through this process, how incredibly expensive this is. And that is what our report lays out, that it is so expensive that it would be much cheaper to just not produce the carbon dioxide right. to begin with.
So what is Canada's current production of GHGs, and where do we need to get to meet our international commitments? Because I know we're not on track even.
Yeah, in fact, we've plateaued, and oil and gas are about 30% of it. But when you think about emissions across sectors, it all is coming back to fossil fuels.
Right.
You know, whether it's a tractor in a farm or natural gas heating up, you know, a stove or an oven or a hot water heater, it's all coming back to fossil fuels. And the fact is that both BC and Canadian greenhouse gases have plateaued. And that is partly because we have continued to put investment in our fossil fuels. In BC, we're pouring tons of money into liquefied natural gas. We've decided to fund another second LNG pipeline. And in Alberta, they are just ramping up and exporting as much oil and gas as they can. And so there's no way that Canada can meet its commitments unless it drastically changes course.
So one of the ways that people are hoping to meet these targets is carbon capture. I don't think it's well understood. It's often sort of thrown out as one of the ways, I don't know, maybe a magic bullet isn't quite the right term, but a way, you know, something other than cutting fossil fuel use as a way to do it.
It's true, you know, when we released our report, there were a couple people that had ties to the fossil fuel industry that were aghast at the fact that our report undercuts what the IPCC, yeah, part of the UN, the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and what the IEA, International Energy Administration, have been saying, that carbon capture is a big part, yeah, of the solution. And in fact, what we show is that it cannot be part of the solution because it is so uneconomical. It's going to be astronomically expensive, and the amount of emissions that it's going to reduce are really insignificant. There's no way it's going to make any serious dent in our greenhouse gas footprint. In fact, what it is doing is acting as a Trojan horse for the fossil fuel industry to pretend like it's offering a clean alternative, when in fact the public taxpayer is going to be on the bill for storing, maintaining, and securing this carbon dioxide for maybe 1,000 years underground, mm-hmm, just like we would for nuclear waste. So it's a massive omni-shambles, and the government is not being honest with the Canadian taxpayer about how much it's going to cost.
So at a high level, I mean, we've alluded to it a bit already, but at a high level, what are the actions we can take to reduce greenhouse gases?
Yeah, well, as individual citizens, we can buy electric vehicles, we can buy heat pumps for our homes, yeah, we can otherwise find ways to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. On a larger scale, we have to talk to our MLAs and our MPs and put pressure on them. My MLA is Rick Glumac. I've been having conversations with him about the foolishness of investing in liquefied natural gas pipelines, when in fact the market is about to collapse because of a glut of oil and gas in international markets, besides the fact that it will create incredible costs. It already is creating incredible costs for us in terms of wildfires, in terms of infrastructure damage, in terms of heat domes, and atmospheric rivers, as right, we're experiencing now. All of these things that politicians tend to forget. The fact is, when I have conversations with them, and I've just spoken to the premier's office as well, they say there's no public push for climate change policy, and that's why they haven't been proactive about it.
But whether or not there's a public push, we need to do this. So carbon capture is potentially one way, obviously reducing the use of fossil fuels, and we've been pretty successful in decarbonizing our electrical production. Are there any other methods, or is it really A or B?
So the good news is that, you know, I think around 96%+ of our electricity in BC is coming directly from hydro. Site C was a massive cost overrun project, but in the end of the day, it will provide clean electricity. The problem for BC is that we're also investing in liquefied natural gas.
Right.
If I just wrote up another report for the Premier's office about the billions of dollars that BC and Canada are using to subsidize these LNG projects. Simply put, it's irresponsible at best, and Honestly, it is an incredibly credible waste of taxpayer resources because the money will be never be paid back. In fact, there are documents about the TMX, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, that shows it is operating at a net loss and it is a massive taxpayer liability. So these investment in fossil fuels are not only foolish from the point of view of environmental policy, but also from economic and financial policy.
So let's talk a bit more about carbon capture, because that's what your report's about. How is carbon captured?
So carbon is captured basically. There are two or three different mechanisms. One mechanism is to use chemical treatment before you put in the petroleum and natural gas. That helps to reduce some of the emissions. Another is to use liquidation methods to try to capture the exhaust, and a third is to simply use filters to try to capture that exhaust. Simply put, it's capturing that exhaust that comes naturally from petroleum and gas production and then putting it into either a pipeline or a truck, shipping it to what they call a geological repository. It's a large cave system. And then pumping it underground and hoping that it will stay there or catalyze with some of the cave materials. There is also that utilization part. So, for example, in carbonation or some silicates, you can use a bit of carbon dioxide to make those products, but it's a very tiny percentage. It's also a very expensive process. Right. The bottom line is it's just so much cheaper to produce these exhausts than it is to capture them.
Right. Well, how complex and expensive is this technology? And is it mature and ready to go, or is it something that needs to be developed?
It's technologically feasible, but as Alberta has started to unroll CCUS, it's found that the costs keep going up and the percentage of carbon dioxide that it's capturing keeps going down. And so while, you know, an engineer would write a blueprint and tell you this technology is ready to go, they haven't thought about the costs of actually making it run. And we have to think about the fact that there could be, you know, a, you know, 40 to 100 kilometer pipeline in Alberta shipping this carbon dioxide from the oil and gas fields into this underground repository. And who wants a carbon dioxide pipeline going through their backyard?
Right.
There was a blowout in Mississippi a couple of years ago for carbon dioxide pipeline, and there wasn't a massive health impact, but there was a massive health scare. A number of people were sent to hospital, and it showed that these pipelines, like oil and gas pipelines, are not foolproof. If anyone tells you, well, natural gas pipelines are safe, they haven't looked at the record of pipelines.
Now, the government is proposing investing quite a bit into this technology. How much are they talking about?
The Pathways Alliance, which is a very nice name for a very powerful industry consortium of oil and gas producers who see CCUS as a great way to greenwash what they're doing, has been lobbying the government. In fact, the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers is by far the most powerful lobbying group in Canada. If you look at the lobby registries, you'll see that they have the most frequent meetings with ministers compared to any lobbying group in Canada. Same for BC. LNG interests dominate the ministers' meetings. And so it's no wonder, absent a public push, that they would favor industry interests above the public interest. So the Pathways Alliance, they're laying out projects that would cost a potential $16 billion. And the Carney government has basically made pledges to underwrite half of that, up to $8 billion in taxpayer money going into this boondoggle.
And in your report, it's not going to achieve the goals it's aiming at, all these projects. Or can they, but not enough?
It's unlikely that they will ever get off the ground for the reasons we discussed earlier. The costs keep rising. There is the NIMBY effect of pipelines going through large parts of Alberta. There is the question about how long the carbon dioxide can be deposited underground in this cave system and how much it will cost to maintain it. In the end, it will be like nuclear waste. even if some of the projects get underway and are successful, they will only capture a small percentage of the carbon dioxide, and whatever's captured will be a long-term public liability.
Right. So part of your concern is that money spent on this solution can't be spent on something else. Where would you rather see money, particularly the federal or government money side of this, being put to address all these issues?
It's a huge contrast, and what's telling is that Danielle Smith, the premier,